So mostly in this class, I won't be giving lectures. Indeed, this is the only time where I'll have a properly constructed quasi-lecture. My general strategy in the class will be to organize this agenda, to have students talk about, you know, begin the conversations by making interventions around the interrogations that they wrote. And then periodically, I will give little short soliloquies to unpack confusion or to bring different threads together. And every once in a while, I have a set piece that I know I'm going to give at some point. And it's a question of just when the opportunity. This is more of a jazz-like quality than a classical music quality to a lot of this, the way you do a seminar. But this is different. I have some issues I'd like to raise, which are basically about the whole problem of what it even means to try to develop a theory of something, like a theory of the state. And in particular, how to think about the relationship between what I like to call concept formation and theory construction. So I've organized an agenda here. We'll just sort of march down it, and I have things to say. I don't want this to be, though, an uninterrupted, you know, hours worth of presentation. Really, just at any point, ask questions, raise queries. I don't think what I have to say has the character of highly controversial things. It's not substantive, it's meta theory. It's about how to think about theory and how to think about concepts. There may be some philosophical conundrums lurking in the weeds here, but I think it's more a question of getting clarifications and specificity to what I have to say. All right, so first, this important distinction between concept formation and theory construction. The simple way to think about it is that you need concepts in order to form a theory. I mean, theories contain words, and the words can either be off-the-shelf folk terms, that just part of common language, or the words can be the labels we give to conceptual categories. The problem is, of course, that concepts get their meaning in part from the theories in which they function, but you can't build the theory unless you have the concepts. So there's this inherently difficult recursive problem in the relationship between concepts and theories. So it's one thing, for example, to have a concept of the state. What do we mean by the state? Debates about the relevance of the monopoly of the legitimate use of violence. That's one of the standard Weberian, you know, formulations in trying to define what constitutes a state as opposed to something else. You know it's a state as opposed to something else when you have, in the Weberian framework, the monopoly of the legitimate means of violence over territory. Aha, that's a state. It's not a band, it's not a mafia, it's a state. Okay, so you can have a concept of the state. That's quite different, I think, from having a theory of the state. There's a constant confusion in sociological discussions between conceptualization and theorization. It's all a muddle. The difference, I think, is that when you're theorizing something, you are actually making what loosely could be called predictions. That is, you're saying something about how pieces fit together, in which if you observe them not fitting together that way, you'd be surprised. You can't be surprised about something unless you have a prediction. That is, if you have a theory of the capitalist state, which says that capitalist states serve the function to reproduce capitalist class relations, it's one of the kind of core, stripped down, you know, without all the adornments and complications, claims of most Marxian inspired theories of the capitalist state. Capitalist states serve the function, difficult idea, serves the function of reproducing capitalist class relations. And then you find a capitalist state that's subverting capitalist class relations, you're surprised about it. Something's amiss. That requires special explanation. That means that we have to say, under most conditions. Well, then what conditions does it reproduce in, and what conditions does it not? All of that means that what a theory does is gives you a set of expectations of one sort or another. They can be strong expectations. That's really hard predictions. If you observe the contrary, it means your theory's wrong. Or they can be probabilistic expectations. If you see a prediction that's outside of your probabilities, it makes you want to check things out more. You have to be surprised if you have a theory. Concepts aren't like that. You know, concepts are, themselves are just the building blocks that enable you to be surprised, but they themselves aren't surprises. So to say, is Weber wrong in defining the state as an organization that has the monopoly of the legitimate use of violence over a territory? Is that an incorrect definition of the state? Well, it may be an unsatisfactory definition of the state, because the phenomena, the empirical phenomena which we observe in the world, to which we want to use this concept, actually get a hell of a lot of things done without using violence. And to foreground violence to such an extent in the very definition is misleading. And so you might say, yes, states do monopolize the legitimate use of violence, but it's misleading to say that that's the key thing that makes a state a state. That that's misleading because it misdirects our attention. Right? And that's a perfectly legitimate, I think, correct critique of the simple version of the Weberian account. Right, so the first point is about concepts and theories and the difficult way of connecting the two. In any theory, concepts will vary in the extent to which they are tightly integrated into a broader conceptual framework or are kind of loose imports into a theory. You know, some people, some traditions of social theory want to have every element of the theory have a tight, coherent, logical location within the overall structure of the theory. And so you create a conceptual framework that is a vocabulary of concepts, which are all very tightly logically connected. And then they're deployed to build a theory which is very tightly logically connected. Neoclassical economics has a bit of that character, you know, where there's no extraneous elements and every element has a logical status and it produces a very clean kind of theory. That's one of the reasons why it can be represented mathematically. And that's one type of theorizing, where you restrict your theory to those concepts which can be very tightly integrated into a conceptual space. Most sociologists just don't function that way. The actual theories they work with are combinations of systematic and coherently developed concepts that fit together, and then loosely coupled concepts that are just imported. It's some combination of eclectic and systematic relationship between concepts and theories. And I think that's fine. It just needs to be recognized as what you're doing. You're not, mostly we're not constructing deductive, logically constructed machines of explanation. We're developing more loosely aggregated concepts. Now, this bears a lot on Marxism as a tradition of thought, as opposed to Marxism as a tightly orchestrated theory where everything fits together. As a tradition of thought, Marxists have always imported lots of concepts that are not particularly Marxist in their character. People who like to style Marxism as a tight paradigm where they draw a sharp contrast, for example, between Marxist theory and bourgeois theory, are trying to fashion Marxism as a fully integrated, tightly constructed conceptual structure to build the corresponding theoretical arguments. Sometimes that takes the form of placing value theory at the core, and everything else has to be derived from that. Right? there was a tradition in the 1970s in Germany called capital logic, where they had this idea of the logic of capital, and everything else somehow flowed from that. The accusation of Marxism as reductionist comes in part from such efforts to find some unifying principle around which every idea can be animated. Well, I think that's an impossible kind of social theory. I guess I don't have an impossibility theorem. That is, I can't prove that we couldn't have an explanation of that character that would be as comprehensive as it imagines as it could be. I've just never seen an example that I find convincing. And it tends to deflect research away from actually identifying puzzles that need answers in order for us to pursue our political and other objectives. All right, point number two on the list. This is about different ways in which you can actually build concepts. So as some of you know, those of you who have read my work, you know that I'm probably on the extreme end among sociologists who have strong theoretical interests, at the extreme end in worrying about concepts. You know, most sociologists take their concepts off the shelf and then use them theoretically. They don't obsess about the meaning of the terms they're using. So, for example, if you look at the literature in social stratification and social mobility, people use occupational categories to define the categories around which mobility occurs, right? That's standard. You'll be hard-pressed to find anybody who does that research who asks the question, what's an occupation? How do we distinguish one from another? What's the appropriate level of aggregation in which we have conceptual boundaries between occupations that matter for the problem of mobility? They just take occupation off the shelf and package it in the kind of folk categories that everybody uses. When I began my career and was worrying about the concept of class, I spent an inordinate amount of time, and still do, worrying about, well, what exactly do we mean by class? What's a class relation as opposed to some other kind of relation? How do we integrate a class relation into a theory of history? What's the relationship between class structure and class formation? How do we locate individuals within a class structure or households? You know, I just worried endlessly about how to think about these concepts. So in the course of that endless worrying, I've developed a number of strategies, not so much by design, these are just the strategies I've used, in which the strategies through which I attempt to build up concepts. And I think it's worthwhile. We'll be encountering some of these strategies and different things we'll be reading, sometimes explicitly, sometimes it's implicit, it's not explicit. In each case, what a strategy attempts to do is to map a space of conceptual distinctions. Right? So to define a concept means, I think, to define the demarcations between one concept and others, to define the space within which any particular concept gets its specificity. So on the back of the first page, the rest of this, I give three examples. These are all drawn from my own work. These are three different ways in which I've gone about the task of building up conceptual spaces. These are concept spaces then within which particular concepts get their meaning. We don't have to belabor this. You can look at these later. But let me just describe what's going on in each of these strategies. Okay, the first is the favorite tool of sociology, the 2x2 table. 2x2 table. So a 2x2 table says that for any concept that you want, not any concept, but you know, for the concepts for which this is an appropriate strategy, most concepts actually pack into the more than one dimension. Two dimensions are way more than one. You know, if you go from one to two, you've really made progress. If there's two dimensions, you can cross them and you have a two-dimensional space. The simplest form is to dichotomize them, but these can be spaces that aren't dichotomized. You'll see if, by the way, one of the hyperlinks in the syllabus online is to a review article I wrote on Peter Evans' book, Embedded Autonomy, about the capitalist state. And I create a two-dimensional space, but which is not dichotomized. It's just a contrast space that has continuous variation in order to understand how some of his cases could be located slightly differently from the way he describes them. All right, so this is a typology which you will see in that in the chapter you're going to read at the end of the semester on how to be an anti-capitalist in the 21st century. The problem I was facing in the how to be an anti-capitalist was thinking about the different strategic logics by which opposition to capitalism is expressed. So the conceptual problem was we observe lots of different ways that people resist and oppose capitalism. Can we classify these different ways into different types? Are there distinctive logics of opposition? And can we give precision to it? Well, you give precision to any one type of logic of opposition through its contrasts with others. And this was a case where I began with two types, smashing and taming. Smashing being the revolutionary ruptural break with capitalism, taming being the social democratic reformist strategy. I just had two types. I then added a third, which doesn't appear here actually at this point, which I called eroding, which is the strategic logic that's bound up with my real utopias approach. And once I had three, I thought, aha, there must be a fourth. So if you want Eric's rules of concept formation, whenever you have a list of three of something, there's a missing fourth. And when you discover the fourth, you've got two dimensions. Right? So I suppose this is a bad joke. That's a kind of unchristian thing to say. It's anti-Trinitarian. It's, you know, it says there has to be four, not three. Three is an awkward number. Okay, that's a bad, inappropriate thing to say in a seminar, I suppose. At any rate, through a series of iterations, I ended up with this 2x2 table, in which eroding then disappeared. Eroding doesn't appear here. And that's because I've come to feel that the way to think about eroding is it's a particular combination of taming, resisting, and escaping. It's not a primary logic. It's a logic that actually combines escaping capitalism, building alternatives, with taming capitalism, changing the rules of the game to solve problems, with resisting capitalism, opposing its depredations. And that eroding capitalism is a particular way of articulating those three strategic logics. Now, that may in itself not be stable. You know, that's my current thinking about this. But you see that this is a process of concept formation. I'm trying to clarify the conceptual distinctions and how they fit together, rather than developing expectations, predictions. I'm not making any kind of prediction as to under what conditions does taming get combined with escaping. No, I'm not. I'm just saying this is a conceptual configuration which, when it occurs, would have the effect, and there you get, that's when I'm deploying it in a theory, of potentially, that's pulling back from the expectation, eroding capitalism. Okay. The 2x2 table, it's a great device. You should all put it in your quiver. You know, as one of the ways of attacking a problem. The typical way in which I develop 2x2 tables is not by beginning with the dimensions and then filling in the table, but by beginning with the categories and asking what are the dimensions which organize them. A conceptual tree. So this is different. This isn't 2x2 tables. This says we have a series of distinctions, and then there are distinctions within distinctions. And you get more refined sets of categories as you move down the tree. This was in my very first publication around in class analysis based on my dissertation, in which in the opening chapter I was trying to locate Marxian class analysis within the spectrum of possible class theories. And I began by saying, well, there's this big difference between, in different class theories, between gradational and relational theories. Then there's relational theories that analyze class in terms of the market and those that analyze it in terms of production. And then within those that analyze it within production, there's those that analyze it in terms of the technical division of labor, authority, relations, and exploitation. And you get Marxian class analysis in the right hand, the lower right hand corner. So this was a way of defining the lines of demarcation among different concepts of class, rather than giving specificity within the concept of class, for example, to different class locations. The third strategy is what I call a qualitative inventory of conceptual differences. We will see this strategy in Joran Terborn's book on what does the ruling class do when it rules. The heart of the first part of Terborn's book is to say all states vary in the way they deal with 11 organizational problems. States are organizations. State apparatuses are machines. They're organizations. You can think of them as organizational technologies to accomplish things in the world. All organizational complexes of this character vary along in terms of 11 qualitatively distinct things they have to solve. How do they get their resources? Right, so every state faces the problem. Where do the resources it uses come from? That's the columns. Where does it get its resources? And then the cells, which distinguish states, are qualitatively different. In the feudal state, the state gets its resources from the lands owned by the king, the king's domain. In the capitalist state, it gets its resources by taxing surplus produced in the capitalist economy. So the difference between the direct physical appropriation of the surplus in feudalism and the taxing of the surplus is a key difference between feudal states and capitalist states. And those represent that's a qualitative inventory of conceptual differences. This is very similar to Weber's ideal types. That's what a Weberian ideal type is. You know, Weber, in his discussion of bureaucracy, has, I forget how many, maybe it's 11 also for some odd reason. I don't know. He has 11 characteristics that distinguish a bureaucracy from other forms. So how does the relationship of an official to the office in a patrimonial administration, they own their office. You know, they have property rights in their office, if I'm remembering correctly. In a bureaucratic administration, they don't. They are hired into it and they can be removed from it. And they can't pass it on to their children. So those are two, that's one component, and that's specifying a difference. Well, that's a qualitative inventory of conceptual difference. The last one is the most kind of primitive. It's sort of this is in my book, Approaches to Class Analysis. It's just a checklist inventory of conceptual difference. So you have a bunch of criteria and you just tick off, is this or is this not relevant? And in this case, I've made a distinction between how relevant a particular issue is for a particular kind of concept. I don't want to get into the substance of this. These are just different strategies. Okay. These are kind of pragmatic considerations. This is, once you engage in the problem of concept formation, how do you go about it? So a lot of you expressed interests about the problem of the relationship between the state and the, you know, sort of the state-private, public-private, how the state navigates that in different ways. One way of thinking about that would be then to try to think about the conceptual space within which the public private boundary is constructed. What are the forms of variation in the construction of that boundary? And what is the appropriate level of abstraction? This is the next point. at which that problem should be posed. So we can specify the boundary between the public and the private conceptually at the level of abstraction of capitalism compared to non-capitalist economic structures. That's what Joran Terborn does. He will have a discussion of the distinction between the public and the private in capitalism and feudalism. But we can also say the boundary between the public and the private varies a lot across types of capitalism. And for many of the problems that I think you're interested in, that's the crucial question. It's not how is capitalism different from feudalism with respect to the public-private boundary. It's how within different forms of capitalism is that boundary constituted. The boundary between the public and the private is very different under neoliberal capitalism than it is under social democratic capitalism. It's quite different in the developmental state than it is in the predatory state. So you need to think about what's the forms of variation of the state within which that boundary is constituted. And indeed, it may turn out, if you really work on that, that it's variations in the construction of that boundary which is the decisive feature in distinguishing different kinds of states. Maybe, I'm not saying this is true, but maybe what's distinctive about neoliberalism is precisely the distinctive way in which the boundary between the public and the private is constituted in the state. It's constituted differently in the ideology of neoliberalism. The question is, how is it actually constituted in the institutions of the state? And the reconstruction of that boundary may be a key part. So that may be a conceptual issue which then unlocks, to use the key metaphor, the secret of what renders neoliberalism such a distinctive form of capitalist development. We're now down to number three. This is a really hard problem, the appropriate level of abstraction at which particular concepts are formed and theories are constructed and empirical research is conducted. This requires really understanding what we even mean by a level of abstraction. What do we mean? What do we mean to say that a particular analysis is more abstract or too abstract? Now, I think this is often really a confused idea. Sometimes when people say it's too abstract, what they really mean is it's too vague. It's just unclear. Well, unclear, it can be unclear and extremely concrete. It's not just the vagueness of something. So there are some very abstract theories which are completely and totally clear. Game theory is an incredibly abstract theory. It's about as abstract as you can get. You know, you've got perfect rationality among decision makers making choices under constrained, you know, payoff matrices or whatever. You can have a very, very abstract theory that is not vague at all. A lot of sociological theory is just vague. The concepts are ill-defined, and how they fit together is not clear. They lack analytical precision. But that's different from the level of abstraction. Level of abstraction has to be thought of, I think, as a particular way of understanding how to add complexity to an analysis. What does it mean to go from highly complex descriptions to simpler descriptions? Now, in some scientific endeavors, this is really clear. For example, in biology, if you want to discuss the example I've always given when I talk about this, when I had a pet dog was my dog Ozzy. Before that, my dog Micah. So Ozzy was a concrete corgi that lived at 1101 Grant Street in Madison, Wisconsin, and was my dog. It points to a very particular concrete animal. He could be described, however, at different levels of abstraction. You could describe Ozzy as a dog, and by describing as a dog, you're saying that Ozzy is like, in certain crucial ways, all the other dogs that live anywhere in the world. They're dogs. Dogs have certain properties in common. They're also mammals. All dogs are mammals, but not all mammals are dogs. To describe Ozzy as a mammal is describing my particular concrete dog at a higher level of abstraction. That is, you're describing Ozzy in terms of his commonality with a broader class of things, but are losing the specificity of that concrete particular creature. Now, for different problems, different levels of abstraction are appropriate. For some questions you might want to ask, all you need to know is that Ozzy is a mammal. That'll lead to the proper expectations about whatever it is you're querying. For other things, it's a would be an inappropriate level of abstraction. It just won't help you explain. Knowing that Ozzy is a mammal won't help you explain why Ozzy sheds all over the house and some other pets don't shed. Being a mammal doesn't explain that. And if you thought that you could have a purely mammalian explanation of animal shedding, you'd be wrong, because it's variations among the category mammal that explain that particular phenomenon, why some shed and some don't shed. Simply being a mammal doesn't explain why some shed and some don't shed. You need other causal properties. Well, the same thing applies to theories of the state. And it raises the question, there may not be a proper theory of the state. It may not, that may be too high a level of abstraction for any question that we care about. We might need a theory of the capitalist state, because that's going to explain things about what states do in capitalism. And we might even more need a theory of the variations in the capitalist state, for which we need at least a concept of the capitalist state in order to have a theory of the variations within it. But I suspect that a theory of the capitalist state is an appropriate thing. I'm not sure if it is possible to have a theory of the state. That is, if there are propositions that can be said about states per se, irrespective of whether they're capitalist states or feudal states or post-capitalist worker states or tributary states of ancient China and Mesopotamia, that we can make an interesting proposition at that level of abstraction for which we have real expectations. Well, maybe there is, but I don't think that's where the main action is. I think the main action, theoretically, is at a lower level of abstraction than the state. We still may need a concept of the state, but the concept gets deployed at its lower levels of abstraction, not its higher levels of abstraction, for the questions that we care about. You know, the questions we care about, or many of us care about, are under what conditions is it possible to successfully struggle for more egalitarian distributions of life chances and conditions of human flourishing. We care about social justice issues. And it may be that a theory posed at the level of the state per se just isn't going to give us much help in that. Whereas theories, again, theories are actual expectations or soft predictions about what you think is going to happen, under what conditions. The theory actually has to be developed at a lower level of abstraction. You will find in lots of writing about the state confusion about this. That is, concepts which are well defined at too abstract a level are being used in explanations that are at a more concrete level, without any recognition of that slippage, right? Now, it's fine to use the concept of the state in its most abstract form in a very concrete setting and just say, that's the best I can do, if it is. You know, we do that all the time. Our theoretical structures don't have enough precision at lower levels of abstraction. At lower levels of abstraction, things often get very ad hoc-ish. You know, you introduce distinctions because they seem important, but you can't give them full theoretical status. They don't fully fit into some theory of forms of variation. So they are descriptive concepts that don't quite yet raise to the level of fully theorized concepts. That is, they don't fully fit into a theory of expectations about something. And that's fine. We have to muddle through. It's just when this all gets not just muddling through, but muddled, and you can't quite figure out what the level abstraction is of the concepts for the context. You'll find, you'll encounter this. This is something to keep your radar on when you're reading things. You'll find mismatches between the level of abstraction at which the concepts are discussed and the level of abstraction in which expectations in the theory are being formed. And it's a real hard problem to solve. I mean, I'm alerting you to a problem. I don't have magical solutions. My work sometimes has that problem. That is, I develop the concept of class at a very high level of abstraction, and I apply it in very concrete contexts. And it's not always the case that the conceptual structure reflects the complexity of the concrete in which it's located. All right. Point four. You're not posing questions, scowling at me, saying you need more elaboration, commenting enough. Come on, say, intervene. I mean, unless what I'm saying is so utterly fascinating and deep that you're just gripped.
So it seems that when we are really thinking about a concept thing, it seems that we have the theoretical presuppositions beforehand, that we are supposed to be in a certain tradition first in order to develop the concept. Or instead, we're thinking about a concept out of the abstraction, I mean, out of the different level of abstractions. I mean, how should we really see it? Like, should we really see it at first? Like, how when we want to develop concepts, we should start from having a certain grand theory that we're going to think in that tradition first? Or should we just start from the concept, like see things empirically, and then we look for some theoretical presuppositions that may match with our concept?
So this is the issue, and we can jump to it. I think that's perfectly fine.
Okay.
It's no. Let's just see. It's where is it? Yeah, it's point eight, the tension between eclectic and paradigmatic approaches. So the paradigmatic approach to social science says you need to pick the best comprehensive theory that you can, whatever you feel is the most coherent, integrated conceptual framework for the problems that you're studying. You don't have to believe that there's one theory of everything, but for the problems you study, you need to commit yourself to that grand paradigmatic framework, develop your concepts with it, and deploy them in your empirical analysis. And then when there are disruptions and tensions, that signals that you have to work on rebuilding and changing the paradigm. Okay, that's one approach. Another approach is this more eclectic one. You begin with a problem. That's a problem that you care about in the world, some empirical or social or whatever issue that you want to understand. And you say there are many different theoretical frameworks that identify many different kinds of processes, and I want to draw from them all as appropriate. So the pure eclectic is somebody who has no commitment whatsoever to any particular conceptual framework, just wants to find whatever's most useful and relevant to whatever particular problem they're doing. And the pure paradigmist starts with a coherent framework and then applies it to particular contexts. And when it doesn't fit, if they're sensible, they then worry about how can we change the elements of the grand theory. I think the best intellectual environment is one where both kinds of practices occur, and in which in one's own work you kind of segue back and forth between them as needed. There are times when it's silly not to bring in concepts from other theoretical traditions that don't fit with what you're doing, because they in fact do identify causal processes better than the theory you're working in. And that might just be a stepping stone towards a higher synthesis, or it might not. It might just end up being that the best you can do is an explanatory program where you bring in from theories of complex organization an understanding of why the bureaucracy is failing in its managing of the refugee classification problem. You know, so In any refugee regime, there's a problem of how do you classify people? And you need procedures for classification. And it could be that theories of complex organizations and organizational culture, which are not Marxist theories at all, they're developed from very different theoretical roots, really understand why bureaucrats consistently screw up on this, right? So you might need it for that purpose, even if your understanding of why the state is contending with refugees in general in a particular way comes from the political economy of labor markets and its need to control the boundaries of labor flows, and it's all bound up with the class and accumulation interface with refugees. You know, so you could have these two aspects of the problem, the big policy domain about why the state is acting in this repressive and exclusionary way, and then the implementation, execution problem where the state is constantly screwing up on its own agendas. And the screwing upness may come from internal organizational pathologies, which are best understood, maybe, from theories of complex organization. So a Marxist who would say, well, that's bourgeois theory, and therefore I'm not going to touch it, would be just silly. I mean, there's nothing in Marxism that develops a theory of bureaucratic pathologies. You know, none of its concepts are suitable for that purpose. Because it doesn't have a set of concepts about the micro-interactional spaces within complex administrative structures. And that's not an embarrassment. The theory isn't designed to do that. One way of thinking about it is that in the concrete investigation of specific projects, specific problems, we know that there are multiple mechanisms at work, and different theoretical traditions are well designed for dealing with different kinds of causal processes. What different theoretical traditions give you are different kinds of questions you'll ask. You're going to get way different kinds of questions if you bring Marxism into a study of refugee labor markets and the like than if you don't, because it alerts you to a whole set of problems that you want answers to. Lauren, you were...
A theoretical framework and a theory, is that a level of abstraction difference, or?
Not really. These terms don't have fixed exactly meaning. Theoretical framework is typically used to mean the overall architecture of a theory, how it's formal design. The word theory can have a theory of very specific things and a theory of very abstract things. Mm-hmm. So the word framework tends to imply that you're talking about how everything fits together. Mm. The expression conceptual framework and theoretical framework are closely allied. The word framework obviously brings them into alignment. That's usually thought of as a pretty abstract way of demarcating how the ideas fit together. Let me jump down, because I think it bears on what we're just been talking about. Let's jump down to number 6.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
So one clarification, and I've seen the expression in your own work too, like at high levels of abstraction. Can I understand this as like at most general level? Could this be translated?
Yeah, so general is one way of talking about abstraction. It doesn't quite capture the issue necessarily. So to get back to our Aussie dog, mammal, living creature, even more abstract, it's not exactly to say that Aussie is a mammal at a more general level than he's a dog. Doesn't quite convey that. The precise idea is that dog is a subtype of mammal. Aussie is a specific instance of a dog, right? And so there's a kind of nested relationship. And the way to think about it is that Aussie is a dog, all dogs are mammals, all mammals are vertebrates, all vertebrates are living things. So whenever you can have a hierarchy of that sort, you're moving up levels of abstraction. And the higher levels are more general in some sense, but it's a little imprecise, I think, to think of it that way. Number six, I think, will be also helpful in terms of, it's nice that we now have these, you know, photo rosters, so that it helps my, the issue that Khan was raising. This is the distinction between the clinical and the scientific use of theory, which is a metaphor I obviously get from medicine, but which I think is really helpful to sociological studies. So here's the idea of the metaphor. When you go to see a doctor because you have a symptom, what does the doctor do? The doctor does a research project on you. Right? That's what a clinician does. Gathers data in a very systematic way. There's a protocol for your, given your symptom, this is the data I will get. I have splitting headaches. Okay, here's the protocol. You have a protocol. And the protocol is organized on two basic dimensions. The cheap data is gathered before the expensive data. So with a headache, you don't immediately get a CAT scan. That's expensive. The first thing you do is take your temperature. That gets data about whether you have an infection of some sort. It goes from cheap to expensive. But also it goes from ruling out big classes of possible underlying causes to rarer underlying causes. Now, a doctor does this experiment, these experiments, gathering data on you in various ways. And the data rule out possibilities and hone in on what is the underlying causal structure that explains the observed symptoms. So the model here is you've got symptoms which you observe, the patient, or which the doctor observes directly. You know, so those are at the empirical level of observation. The underlying philosophy of science is that there's some generative causes in the body that are producing the events that are experienced as symptoms, and you're trying to figure out what those are. And the way we can figure it out is because we know those causes generate other indicators, right? So what a CAT scan tells you is that the thing which is producing your headache is also producing this black mark on the CAT scan or whatever it is that it produces. So that's a really interesting idea, right? That the causal structure here is that it produces the symptoms you immediately observe. That's the level of appearances, to use an old Marxian idea. But it also produces other things which you can't directly observe. You can only observe them by intervention, in which the clinician is intervening in the world. That's what a CAT scan is. It's an intervention into your world in order to get additional data. And when you get these two bits of data together, a headache plus this indicator on the CAT scan, now we know what that generative cause is. At the end of the day, the clinician has a sigh of relief. We've got you diagnosed. Unfortunately, it's a brain tumor, but still. The clinician has completed the research. At the end of that research project, we can say the clinician knows a lot about the case, but has learned nothing from the case. That is, the case study of your headache has produced no advance in the scientific knowledge of headaches. And the clinician is happy when the research that the clinician does on you does not produce new knowledge of a general scientific or theoretical character. Because the only way that the research on you could produce new knowledge would be if the research was unable to properly diagnose your own condition. And therefore, it challenged the existing categories, and the clinician had to cleverly figure out something new. Well, most clinicians can't do that. So that's clinical science. And a lot of sociology is clinical in that sense. I mean, a lot of what sociological analysis consists of is a sociologist or, you know, other social scientists have a toolkit of theories. They may have one theory in their tool bag. That's the paradigmist. Or they may have a whole menu of theories for different kinds of causes because they're an eclectic, you know. So they may have, Bourdieusian cultural theory and Marxian exploitation theory and Weberian bureaucratic power theory in their tool bag, and they go to a problem that they're interested in. Refugees in the Thailand state, and they diagnose it successfully by pulling up these tools. That's the clinical practice of sociology, learning a lot about a case, but not necessarily learning much from the case. Learning something from the case means that there has to be something that you've changed in that toolkit by virtue of what you've studied. You know, if the toolkit remains unchanged by this research, if all the theoretical ideas that are brought to bear remained unchanged, you may have produced an absolutely brilliant analysis of this particular problem, which may be super important. I mean, it may be absolutely important for social struggles to properly diagnose why the state is behaving the way it is. And you may have successfully done it because you're really smart at applying the tools. There are good clinicians and bad clinicians, after all. There are clinicians who are really deft at figuring out what the causes of your illness is. So it's no mean accomplishment to diagnose a case, to learn everything needed from it in order to animate struggles to change it. But that's still not the same as changing the toolkit, changing the theoretical machinery that you use to do the diagnosis. Now, I think it's absolutely fundamental to sociology to do both of these things. I don't think it's in fact a mistake that sometimes students make because, you know, the grand theories of the discipline are stuff that you learn, and you'll be exposed to some of that in this class. You'll see, you know, somebody like Joran Terborn who attempts to make this grand reconstruction of the theory of the capitalist state by really proposing this strong conceptual structure for understanding variation. Very bold book, What Does the Ruling Class Do When It Rules? And there's sometimes a feeling, that's what I got to do in order to, you know, really be successful. Well, I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think that the clinical stuff, using the tools to diagnose a case, that's the bread and butter of what a lot of politically minded and theoretically minded sociologists do. And that is generative of reconstructing the theory, because that's where you discover where the theoretical failures are, where the anomalies are, where the puzzles in the theory that can't just be applied, they have to be resolved. If you don't get in the trenches and do that kind of work, you don't generate the right kinds of reconstruction of the theory. You can't, and particularly at the beginning of careers, you know, this is also a question of historical moment. There are historical moments in which there's so many ideas floating around because everybody is working on reconstructing the big ideas that you can intervene even early on in that sort of way. I mean, that's sort of how I found myself in the 70s. I was in the thick of things in the renaissance of Marxist theory after the long period when it was just mostly dogmatic. And it was being reconstructed all over the place. There were all these ideas floating around, and that's what we were all engaged in and arguing about. And there was lots of innovation to be done because it hadn't been done yet. It was, in a sense, an easy time to jump into the thick of that sort of concept reconstruction and theory formation project. I think that was a result of the nature of the intellectual world that was at the time, not just my own particular intellectual capacities or whatever. That my biography intersected that historical moment. I think the main thing to think how to think about this in terms of the work you're doing. You all, you know, laid out interests that are real interests. They're interests engaged in real problems in the world, and that's where you then apply these conceptual tools and the various theoretical bits of machinery you've got to really understand those cases. And sometimes what you'll be doing is you'll building a new theory of that kind of phenomenon. So there may not be, while there may be theories of bureaucratic failure and theories of political economy of labor markets, there may not be a theory of how bureaucratic failures and labor markets come together around flows of refugees or whatever. But it may not actually be, you may not actually develop a general theory of that. That is, there may not be a higher level of abstraction at which that problem can be posed. It may only be posable as the intersection of these particular causal processes. We're running out of time. Let's see. Let's go to number does that clinical versus scientific thing clear? I think it's a really useful thing to have in your pocket, you know, as one of the ways you read theory and read empirical work. And think about the nature of the contributions. Okay. Number four, the problem of being clear on precisely what is the object of explanation, fine-grained versus coarse-grained objects of explanation. Fine-grained versus coarse-grained. Let me give you an example, which is a well-known example, not usually discussed in the way I'm going to present it, but a well-known example in political sociology. In the early 1980s, Theda Skocpol and Anne Orloff intervened in discussions of the development of the welfare state, in which they were very critical of Marxian explanations because they said, look, the American welfare state was retarded, you know, delayed in its development till the 1930s because in 1865, right after the Civil War, it developed the most developed welfare state in the entire world in the form of Civil War pensions. So Civil War pensions were instituted in the United States in the aftermath of the Civil War for Northern soldiers, not for the Confederate soldiers. And it grew to be an enormous apparatus of providing income to Civil War veterans. And it became incredibly corrupt because the administrative capacity of the state was so weak. So we had an underdeveloped administrative capacity with a huge welfare program in the form of pensions, which completely discredited the role of the state in providing pensions, which then killed for two generations, basically, until the Civil War pensioners were all dying off, which is what occurred, what's happening by the 30s, of course. It delayed for two generations the emergence of a proper welfare state. Whereas, the reason why it occurred earlier in England and in Canada. So it was a comparison of Anglo, you know, the Anglo world, the English-speaking world, which were rather similar in their ideological and political views. The sequence was the first welfare, social security type welfare occurs in England, then in Canada, and then in the United States. And she asks, why that sequence? And the sequence is because of the historical specificities and conjunctural analysis of how states and bureaucracies and completely contingent facts like Civil War pensions get introduced. So you needed what she called a state-centered view. And she was critical of the kind of political economy views which sees the development of the welfare state and of pensions as solving general problems in the reproduction of labor power, which is a kind of political economy view and class view. Okay, so my response to Skocpol on that was that this all depends upon how coarse-grained or fine-grained your question is. If we want to ask the question, why does no capitalist state have a old age pension system in 1850, and why does every wealthy capitalist state have it by 1950? Why in the early Industrial Revolution none have it, and by the mature Industrial Revolution everybody has it? To answer that question, the answer is it's necessary for the reproduction of capital, of capitalism, because of the problems of reproducing labor power under market uncertainty. If you want to ask why the specific sequence, why it occurs, you know, in 1904 in England and 1922 in Canada, 1933 in the United States, then you have to, that's a much more fine-grained explanation at a much lower level of abstraction. And then all sorts of contingent, less abstract causal processes come into play. Jerry Cohen expressed this brilliantly. He has a wonderful essay on functional explanations, which are, you know, part of his way of thinking about Marxism. He argues that it's one thing to say that we explain the emergence and consolidation of Protestantism as a religious form because of the functions it serves for the development of capitalism. That's the kind of Marxian view. And another thing to say that we can explain why the articles of faith of the Anglican Church are numbered 22 rather than 33. I mean, I don't know if I got the numbers right. Because of the functions that serves for capitalism. And he says, no, of course, you can't have a functional explanation for why there are a particular number of articles in the religious faith. That has to do with the logic of internal development of theological and religious disputes and the contingent facts about what it meant to break away from the Catholic Church in the reign of Henry VIII when the articles of faith were being formulated. Very contingent features that have nothing to do with the development of capitalism. But why does Protestantism become a consolidated religious force in the 16th century and not the 12th century has to do with how it fits into the dilemmas and conditions of reproduction and expansion of capitalism. Well, he may be wrong about that, but it helps to explain the logic. So it's very important in thinking about the kinds of concepts you're using and the kind of theoretical explanations you're proposing, precisely what you're trying to explain. And what you're trying to explain, I think, always means how fine-grained is the variation you're trying to explain. Even if you don't think you're explaining variation, you're only trying to explain why something happened in a particular case, it still is in a space of variability where other things happen in other cases, even if they're not explicit. There's always variation is the heart of what explanations are about. And that's the point number four. Well, it's 5:00. We can go at least quickly down the rest if you want the full inventory, just if you're patient enough and can stay a little bit. Okay. Heterogeneity of explanatory logics. Ooh. For those of you who, some of you have taken Sociology 621, my sociological Marxism course, which, by the way, just by way of advertising, that's my favorite course in the world. That's the course where all my heart is located, where my intellectual, all my ideas, almost all of them come out in that class in one corner or another. So I don't mean to be self-promoting, but I really like teaching that class, and I think students who take it find it a useful thing to do. Okay, well, we talk about that there. There are three primary logics of explanation. What does it mean to explain something in social science? And all of these come into play in theories of the state, and they're often very confusing because it's not always very explicit as to what kind of explanatory principle is being used. These are the three, I think, that I think are the most important. There are some other kind of logics of exposition that occur. It's not always so clear if they're explanatory or not. So there's interpretive sociology or hermeneutic sociology. It's not clear when you're trying to reveal the inner meanings of things whether you're actually trying to explain them or there's some other task you're doing. Okay, but these are explanatory tasks. Causal explanations, functional explanations, and intentional explanations. Now, it'd be way too much for me to, right here, go in and explain all the contrasts. I can do the simplest version. An intentional explanation is where you explain why something happens by the purposes of the actors. You know, so for theories of the state, that's a big part of how things get explained. Why does the state do what it does? It does what it does because it's in the interests of the capitalist class. What's the mechanism? Well, the capitalist class have a lot of power, and they have various ways of ensuring that the state does things in its interests. That's called an instrumental theory of the state, where the state is an instrument of the capitalist class. It may be an imperfect instrument. Sometimes they may screw up. Sometimes they may make mistakes. But the core explanation is that there's a source of power outside of the state. That source of power is connected to clear or sometimes at least important interests. And the actors who wield that power see to it that the state does things that it's in their interests. And when the state deviates from that, they punish it in various ways. So a theory of the state that sees capitalists as engaging in capital strikes to get their way, to force the state back into the true path of serving their interests, that's also instrumental. That's intentional explanations. Functional explanations say the state does what it does because it contributes to the reproduction of capitalism, but not because it's ordered to do so by capitalists, not because there's some manipulation going on by powerful actors who know what they're doing, but because the state is built in such a way that it generates policies that reproduce capitalism. It has a design of its apparatuses that, when done well, ensures that anti-capitalist policies are excluded and reproductive policies come out of the state. Its actions reproduce the relations of production. That's a functional explanation. It's a functional explanation is familiar in biology. Why do birds have hollow wings? Because if their wings weren't hollow, they would be too heavy and they couldn't fly. Hollow wings are explained by their beneficial effects for the aerodynamics of birds. And that's a good explanation. And we know what the mechanisms are, natural selection. That's how we have an account, survival of the fittest and natural selection. Well, there are similar, if somewhat less compelling, versions of natural selection in the design of institutions. Institutions are very flawed. When they break down and they don't work very well, actors in a fumbling way change them. And once they start working well, they stop changing them. Now, that process of adaptation may be sped up if the actors have some insight into what changes might make it work better. But you don't even have to imagine that they're all that smart. It's just that institutions are redesigned and changed until they start working well. And so it's still really it's the functionality of the fit that is doing a lot of the explanatory work, because that explains when they stop trying to change things, even if there are still some intentionality going on. You can think of this for capitalist firms in a market. We observe that capitalist firms generally have strategies which really reproduce capital accumulation. You know, they generally have strategies that generate profits. Well, that can either be because capitalists are really, really smart and they figure it all out, how to maximize their profits, or because they're bumbling along and a lot of them are pretty stupid, but it's just the ones that actually come upon strategies that maximize profits are the ones that survive. And when they get into trouble because they're not maximizing profits, then they change things until they start maximizing profits again. And if they don't change things, they go under. So a functional explanation also works in sociology, but it's more vulnerable. It's not as tight as in evolutionary biology. A lot of theories of the state have functional explanations built into it. That's what we'll be discussing next week. We're going to do 1 week on that because that's part of the legacy of the Marxian tradition, but mostly we're not going to be focusing on functional explanations. And causal explanations are, I think, the most familiar. Causal explanations simply say the state does what it does because there are certain causal processes in play. It has these institutions right now. And these institutions make it impossible for it to do certain things and make it more likely to do other things. Whether or not those are functional or not is a separate question. It's just that you explain the outcome on the basis of certain kinds of dynamics and properties. All right, that's number 5. We've mentioned 6. The double discipline of concepts and theories. Okay, so the double discipline problem is especially relevant if you are a paradigm builder. So if you're committed to using a particular theoretical framework and then reconstructing it, which I have been in my career, so I the way I would describe myself is a paradigmist with an eclectic fringe. You know, so that I have no hesitation to borrow from all sorts of other theories when I'm trying to explain things, and you know, sort of without embarrassment, to be both a Marxist and a Weberian, and even in some special cases, a Marxist and a Parsonsian. Ooh. But my main commitment is to try to reconstruct the Marxist tradition and to make its theoretical ideas and its concepts more coherent and more powerful. Okay, so the double discipline. What that means is when you make a conceptual innovation of one sort or another, you have two tasks. One is to see how well does this new concept fit into the existing theoretical framework in which it's to function. So when I was working on the concept of class and trying to figure out how can we cope with the idea of a middle class within a Marxian framework, what's middle about the middle class, I introduced the concept of contradictory locations within class relations. It was a way of thinking about certain positions within the class structure being simultaneously in more than one class. It's a particular way of kind of getting a handle on the non-binary character of a class structure. It was that some class locations had relational properties that put them in more than one class. Managers were simultaneously workers and capitalists by virtue of the complex connection between authority relations and property relations. With respect to property relations, they were workers. With respect to authority relations, they were capitalists. Capitalists were dominant on both of those dimensions. Workers were subordinate on both of those dimensions. Managers had this contradictory location. Okay, so that was a conceptual innovation. And the first question I had to ask, the first part of the double discipline is, does that still fit into the broader conceptual framework that is a Marxian account of class and exploitation? And I felt it did, that what I had done was said, look, we can take that Marxian idea, which at the level of abstraction of capitalism has a binary class relation, we can bring it down a level of abstraction to actual capitalist enterprises and firms where we see that this binary relation is more complicated because it doesn't all fit together, and it has these double, this two-sided face to it, authority and property, they fit together. And yes, if we think about the levels of abstraction, and you can still have a exploitation-centered Marxian concept and have a contradictory class location. And then that was the disciplining of the concept by its place in the theory. And then was, well, does it do you any good when you actually try to study things? Are there expectations of an empirical sort that you would have by virtue of having this concept that you can then track and see if the observations in the world make sense in light of this conceptual innovation? And in those terms, I engaged, for example, in an empirical debate with Nikos Poulantzas, who had a different way of understanding the middle class. And I showed, I think, that my way of doing it, the contradictory class locations, actually got you better predictions. The expectations about how, what would be the class levels of class consciousness or attitudes and ideologies of people located in different places in the class structure made more sense if you saw them as contradictory locations than if you saw them as new petty bourgeoisie, which is how he thought about it. And so that my conceptual innovation actually fitted into a predictive theory, expectations, where in which the observations corresponded better to mine. I used the expression adjudication. I was adjudicating between these two conceptual frameworks in light of how they both fit into the first discipline of the theory and the second discipline of the data. That's the double discipline, that concepts need to be accountable to the theory in which they fit and in the empirical work that they're used for. It never is really as neat as all that. There are, as I, if any of you have read my sometimes agonizing trajectory through different formulations of my own views on class, whenever I feel smug and self-satisfied that I've now finally wrapped it all up and I've got everything nicely coherent on both dimensions, I then begin to realize, no, something's not right here. Either there's some little conceptual theoretical part of the discipline which just isn't working, that I discovered in my first formulation that actually exploitation isn't doing any work in the theory anymore. It's all about domination. I'm sounding too much like a Weberian. And that shift from exploitation to domination was a problem of the fit between my concept and the broader theory. And that misfit, even though it was working quite well empirically, that misfit led me to rethink once again the class concept. At some point, you just stop and you muddle through. You say, well, this is as good as I can do for now. Let's get on with business. All right, that's the double discipline. I've talked about eclectic, the tension between these two approaches. We've talked about the crucial importance of variation. Just always think about variation, whatever you're doing. So even if you're doing a single case study, I guess I keep referring to the Thai case just because you're directly in my line of sight. You know, ultimately you want to know the differences between the way the Thai state is dealing with this and the Malaysian state is dealing with it, and, you know, and different contexts, because it's the variations that actually end up giving real specificity to any given case. But often it's just impractical. You know, it's exhausting to do one case, and so sometimes that's what you do. But there still should be in your own imagination, and as you think about it, what's the space of variation within which any given case is located? And that helps to give precision to what you're trying to study. And finally, the centrality of normative issues. That's a huge, big issue. I think we are too late to kind of get into that fully. Second chapter, well, no, I guess it's the first chapter after the introduction in Envisioning Real Utopias. I don't know if I put, is that on the emancipatory social science discussion? I might have put that in the syllabus here. Let's see. No, I didn't put that in here. Well, I have an extended discussion of what I call emancipatory social science and trying to justify what its normative foundations are at the beginning of Envisioning Real Utopias. Envisioning Real Utopias is on my website, so you can just look at that chapter. I think it's called What is Emancipatory Social Science or something like that. The basic idea here is whatever else defines the Marxist tradition, it's one of a family of theoretical traditions that has as its point of departure a normative agenda. You're not a Marxist just because you're curious about explaining things in the social world. I mean, you may be also curious. You may find it just fascinating and intellectually interesting to study the world. But no one would ever be drawn to Marxism simply because of its intellectual power as an explanatory structure. Again, although I think it has tremendous power as an explanatory structure, as a theoretical structure, people are drawn to the Marxist tradition and other critical and emancipatory frameworks of social analysis because they want to change the world. They want to make the world a better place. They want to understand the world in order to change it, not understand it in order to admire it or to just be curious about it. And that normative grounding is crucial because it directs you to ask certain kinds of questions rather than others. The word emancipatory is, you know, I tried to, when I was writing Envisioning Real Utopias, that's the first time I really decided, well, what's the best word to use to describe the most encompassing idea? You could say critical, you know, that's often used, critical theory, critical social science, or radical. Radical isn't very good because you can be on the radical, you can be radical reactionary or radical progressive. Progressive seemed too narrowly political in a, you know, specific sense. I settled on emancipatory. But then Stephen Lukes, when I gave a presentation about these ideas early on, Stephen Lukes at NYU, a well-known political sociologist, he said, you know, the word emancipation is a very narrow expression. It comes from the struggle against slavery. You know, emancipation just means freed from the bondage of a master. We refer to the emancipation of adolescents when they reach the age of 18. They're emancipated from their parents. They're no longer under the control of. So the emancipation, the idea of emancipation focuses only on the freedom dimension of the much more complex normative space that includes equality and democracy and solidarity. So emancipatory social science doesn't intrinsically evoke the idea of community and solidarity, although I think that term has been sufficiently appropriated by the left that it, in fact, has this broader set of meanings. So there's a footnote to Stephen with this point, but I still think it's the best word we have. Emancipatory social science is a social science that has as its first commitment developing knowledge in order to struggle against oppression. It's committed to the reduction and challenge of oppression wherever it occurs. Different kinds of oppression have led to the development of different kinds of emancipatory social science. So feminism is when it's social science rather than just social theory or a philosophical position, you know, feminism as a social science is a social science developed to diagnose and understand the conditions for the oppression of women, or more broadly, gender inequality and gender domination, which is broader than just the oppression of women. Marxism, I think, is above all an emancipatory social science anchored in the analysis of class. It's about class emancipation in the first instance. It may also have ramifications for gender emancipation and racial emancipation and other forms of emancipation, but it's not a theory of those forms of emancipation. It's crucial to understand its ramifications for these other forms of emancipation and their ramifications for class emancipation, of course. But Marxism itself doesn't contain any specific concepts that are directly relevant as Marxian concepts for the problem of male domination and the forms of inequality and injustice that are built around gender. So emancipatory social science has as its grounding this idea of emancipation from forms of oppression. But it is also social science, and both words are crucial. The science part says that in order to have social emancipation from these various forms of oppression, we need real knowledge about how the world works. It's not enough just to be pissed off. It's not enough just to identify who the enemies are. We have to understand the nature of the dynamics and constraints and dilemmas that are in the world that are generated by real causal structures. We need real scientific knowledge. And I take the science and scientific really seriously. The key thing for me about scientific claims is that they can be wrong and that we have a method for improving them when they are wrong. They're correctable. It's not that they eliminate error. There's lots of scientific understandings that are wrong, but that they contain within themselves not only the possibility of removing error or improving knowledge, but a commitment to doing so. That's the science part. The social part says that the sources of oppression are not primarily the lack of enlightenment of the inner self, but they're social. They have to do with the way institutions are built and power is organized, not just the inner states of people. Now, that isn't to say that the inner state of people, that enlightenment isn't part of a process of emancipation, but it says that it's insufficient. What needs transforming is not just the inner self. What needs transforming is the institutions, power relations of the world. And that's where the capitalist state becomes a particularly important topic, because it is simultaneously both one of the sites of transformation, its institutions need transforming, and one of the crucial barriers to transformation. Its actions block efforts at transforming the social world. And that's what we need to grapple with. That, for me, that's the most important theme that should run throughout the whole course. Now, there's lots of other themes that we'll be encountering. Some of the writers aren't particularly concerned with social emancipation. When you read Michael Mann, who I think is quite brilliant, and his interventions in the theories of the state are actually very important, but you'll be hard-pressed to find any place where anything, even a shadow of a concern about social emancipation occurs. he's actually a very progressive guy. I mean, it's not that he's certainly not a reactionary at all. But his book is, and books are not built around the possibility of human emancipation. It's almost about the inevitability of different forms of domination, and not how can you escape them, but how they work so malevolently to keep you under tow. It's not a cheerful book, but yeah. So, but I think it's the theme that should drives this and makes me continually interested. All right, well, hope this is the only lecture you're getting from me all semester, guys, so.
How about we create a Google group for these interventions? Have you found one?
Just let me just, I want to just turn, I was just... Yeah.